Blog Talk Radio.
Hey.
Once upon a long time ago. You know, there's a couple of lyrics there in that song that I think of Eastern Airlines as a house to grow old. A house to grow old, if you recall the singer singing that. And because of that, there are a lot of folks that go there in their mind back to a long time ago with Eastern Airlines. Today we've got some hosts that have been with us before. George Jen and Jim Holder are with us. Hey, George and Jim, you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
I'm here, Neil.
Okay, well, I want to tell you, last week we had the following that listened to us by going to the website and tuning us in there. They didn't listen to us live, but they did listen to the archive version. And I want to say thanks a lot to Australia, Malaysia, Thailand, Russia, India, Yemen, Kenya, Republic of Serbia, Slovakia, Switzerland, Germany, Denmark, the United Kingdom, Finland, the Ukraine, France, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Senegal, Brazil, Argentina, Peru, Canada, Dominican Republic, and Mexico. So if you're one of or two of those listeners in those countries, we thank you for tuning us in via the computer and listening to our stories and songs. And we've got a little bit more of that today for you. So at any rate, I've got a couple of things on my mind to talk about. And if you guys want to vary it to whatever you feel like you want to talk about, whether it's your Eastern or Air Force days or how you got started in flying or whatever the heck you want to talk about, we'll do that between some great songs that your producer has chosen for this show. And one of the first things I want to ask each of you guys is, what did you do after Eastern went out of business? What's the first thing, or the first job, I should say? Or did you have a job? Or did you want a job? Or did you just retire and start making drinks made out of Maker's Mark? Just what the heck did you do? Hey, George, your turn. What did you do after Eastern folded? Or did, I think you left a little bit early, didn't you?
Yes, I did, Neil. I left in 88, which was 3 years before it formally went out of business, a little less, probably 2.5 years. And I went to work for another major airline as a pilot. You know, it was kind of, the handwriting was on the wall with what Lorenzo was doing to the airline selling off all the profitable parts and leaving just the junk left over as the excuse to come after the employees. And I figured it was only a matter of time until he once again filed for bankruptcy. And, you know, this time who knew where it would go. But without it, many of its primary assets, like the shuttle, South America, the computerized reservation system, just to name three, I didn't see much future for Eastern. So I was fortunate enough in that I was still young enough to go somewhere else. But of course, it wasn't easy starting over at the bottom of the list, pulling the gear for guys who were 10 or 15 years younger than me. You know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. When you went over to the other carrier, I won't use the name unless you want to use it yourself, but at any rate, was it, did they ask you why you left Eastern and Eastern was still in business?
No one asked me that. I thought that was pretty interesting because it would have been, as you know, I mean, I was a an ALPA elected representative for 6 years and was on the Pilot System Board of Adjustment for probably 8 years. And but no one ever asked me, which I thought was kind of interesting because the carrier that I went to work for was also represented by ALPA. But when the chief pilot came in to address the new hire class, he said, well, we have one union radical in this class. And at that point, I think everyone kind of turned around and looked at me. You know, there was no doubt about who he was referring to, you know.
Yeah. Now, Jim Holder, you had a little different you also went with another carrier. So let me ask you, was it right after Eastern shut down? Had you already considered going with this carrier?
Neil, no, it was not. I was the council chairman in Atlanta during the latter part of the strike, and we had a difference of opinion of what we wanted to do, at least in the Atlanta council, and I resigned, and another guy took my place. And then the strike occurred, and almost just a few weeks after the strike occurred, the shutdown and all that, my youngest daughter had surgery. surgery that failed, and she was in a coma for about almost 3 years. And I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go anywhere. Her mother and I were divorced, and her mother had a job, and I didn't. So I was primarily the one taking care of the situation with my daughter. But she eventually passed away. And I was advised that ATA, American Transair, already had quite a few Eastern pilots there, many of which knew my situation, and they knew that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go for another airline. But ATA bought 8 727-200s with extra gas and bigger engines, and they needed 727 pilots, and this was shortly after my daughter passed away. And I heard about that, and I called up there to an Eastern, two or three Eastern guys were already there in management already to a certain extent. And I talked to them, and they said, get your application up here post-haste. And I did, and I spent all day Sunday with an electric typewriter writing a resume, the first time I'd ever done it in my life. It looked like it snowed inside my house with all of the paper wadded up on the floor. So I finally got one I liked, and I mailed it the next day, like the overnight mail, and called to make sure they got it, and she said we did get it. And this other Eastern guy that was there, he was the 727 fleet manager, Charlie Boswell, he called me because he had told me he was going to make sure that I got an interview. He could said, I can't make sure you get hired, but I'll make sure you get an interview. And he came back from Boeing and called me late that night, Thursday night, and said, I couldn't find your application until I looked on another stack, and you've already got an appointment to come up here to be interviewed. I said, yeah, I do. So I went up there, and they hired me, and I was in a class of 26, and I was the oldest one. So at ATA, 26 numbers meant like about 400, 500 numbers anywhere else. And they had me. I remember the chief pilot came out and was talking to us for the new hire class, which was, I think about 15 pilots and about 10, 11 flight engineers, mostly from the Air Force. And he said it went around and everybody, had too much time you have doing all this. And most of the management were ex-Braniff and Continental, and they were very sympathetic with Eastern, of course, and they asked me, Jim Holder, how much time do you have in the 727, because we were starting out on the 727. And I said, well, I've got about 12,500 hours, by the guess, you know, like that. And that's why they hired me, of course. And they put me flying with these young guys that many had never flown captain, and most of them didn't have much jet time, and here they were going to be flying captain out of Midway. And with its famous short runways and everything. And when I went up there for my check ride, I had Tom Hopp, Eastern captain, was already at ATA, and he was giving me the check ride. And Hap Slayton, who's a highly regarded senior captain in Miami, was there. He was a 10-11 instructor at ATA. And he was running the panel. So I felt right at home, and I hadn't flown anything in like – 3.5 or 4 years, and it was Eastern's very first simulator, Tom told me. It was Eastern's very first 727 simulator. No motion, no nothing, you know, just a basic simulator. So they put me with these young guys, and I had a good time. They were a bunch of good guys, too, and one of the captains I flew with, he was brand new. He was the son of Bill Williams, who was in my new hire class at ATA. I mean, at Eastern in 1963. He said, I can't believe it. He had to, you know, his dad had never even met his mother. And here he's in the left seat, and I'm in the right seat. And he said, this is something wrong with this picture here, you know. And I said, no, don't worry about it, you know. And I really enjoyed flying with those young guys. I flew with a lot of young guys. And they were quite honestly glad to have me there flying out of Midway.
Well, George, that's pretty much when you went over to the other carrier, you must have been the oldest guy in the class, or were you about the same age as the – were there new hires in that class that you went over with?
Yes, there were, Neil, and I was the oldest one. So I got, you know, 23 numbers out of 3,000. But I had originally applied to Piedmont, and I'm sure Jim remembers Bob Kuntz. He was the MEC chairman at Piedmont. And at one of the board of directors meetings of ALPA, he came over to me. He said, you know, George, why are you messing around at Eastern? He said, why don't you just come on over here to Piedmont? And he said, you know, they'll hire you, and, you know, you'd be a captain in a couple of years. So I sent my, like Jim, you know, I never had a resume put together, but I put one together, and I mailed it to Bob. And sure enough, they contacted me within a week, and I went down there for the interview, and they told me you're hired. We'll get back to you with a new class date. And then they were purchased by U.S. Air. And I had never even applied to U.S. Air, and I figured, well, I'll never hear anything further. But U.S. Air called me, and so I wound up like Jim. You know, when I went for the interview, they said, well, how many hours do you have on a 727? I said, well, I figure I got about 11,000 hours on the airplane. And so what they did was, you know, at the time, that was the largest airplane that they had. They had, like Jim described, the U.S. Air had the last 10 that were built with the large engines and the big fuel tanks, and they were flying them coast to coast. So it was either a very senior or a very junior airplane at U.S. Air, and they had, the way it was explained to me was that they had some captains who didn't have much experience in the 727, so they wanted, you know, somebody to fly with them who knew the airplane. So they made me an FO on the 727 right away. And then, you know, things kind of fell into seniority order after a year or two. But it was interesting. You know, it was very different. The mindset of the pilots, as I'm sure Jim's friend Jim Gardner could tell him, was very, very different at U.S. Air than what it was at Eastern. It was very pleasant for a few years until this, you know, it was almost a rerun of what happened at Eastern, almost, but not quite. But the end result was pretty much the same.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's talk some more about Eastern just as soon as we hear one of my favorite crooners, and I mean he was good. Here he is.
Don't let the stars get in your eyes, don't let the moon break your heart. Love blooms at night, in daylight it dies. Don't let the stars get in your eyes, oh, keep your heart from me, for someday I'll return, and you know you're the only one I'll ever love. Too many nights,
too many nights,
too many stars,
too many stars,
too many moons to change your mind.
Don't let the moon change your mind.
If I'm gone too long, don't forget where you belong. When the stars come out, remember you are mine. Don't let the stars get in your eyes, don't let the moon break your heart. Love blooms at night, in daylight it dies. Don't let the stars get in your eyes, oh, keep your heart from me, for someday I'll return, and you know you're the only one I'll ever love.
Dean Martin, wasn't it?
Nope.
Nope. What was it, Perry Como?
Perry Como. Perry Como.
Oh, yes, that's right. I could have. Yeah. Yep.
Well, today's songs are all crooners. I call them crooners. Mm-hmm. That particular song is not what you would expect to be crooning, I guess. I don't know what the hell crooning means, but I think it's a soft type of touch. But let's talk some more about Eastern and what we did. I heard your stories, and I've got a story too, because I resigned a month before Eastern went out on strike in 1989. And like you said, George, I saw writing on the wall, as I'm sure just about everybody around that time before the March Madness. It wasn't madness. It was March good thinking. But I told my wife, I said, you know, we ought to get out now. And we did. I turned in my resignation and went through the procedures, and I knew the drill. Called Miami and requested to be retiring. And so they honored it. And at any rate, what happened next was that, if you remember, Peter Uberoff came along, and it looked like it was really going to be, you know, run by some solid leadership. And so I quickly called in Miami, and I said, disregard my notice of retirement. I want to stay with the company. And they said, well, if you want to stay with the company, you got to come back to work. And I said, what do you mean? They said, you've got to cross the line. You got to come back with us. I forgot who I talked with down there. And I said, well, thanks, but no thanks. I'll walk the streets. So I did in Pensacola. I had my sign on my front and walked with the guys all living in the Pensacola area. And it was interesting, but shortly after that, I got the Labor Protection Act that gave the Eastern pilots the first rights to return with Continental Airline on the new hires, because they had taken our airplane 757s. You remember that, George and Jim? And I opted for that option, that I wanted half of what they were offering, plus be able to go back to work with Continental and going to their ground school on the DC-10. And so I did, and they called me and said, do you want to come back to work? And I was 62, I think, at the time. And I said, well, I can't fly. I'm over 60. And at that time, 60 was a mandatory age. And they said, no, we've got a spot for you in a flight engineer class on the DC-10, along with the other bunch of Eastern people that we're honoring. So I said, yeah. So I went to Houston and went through the DC-10 ground school and getting ready to take my check ride. I went through the simulator, getting ready to take my check ride, and then the notices came out as to where this class was going to be based, and they were going to base me in Guam. And I said, no, I don't think I want to work for Continental. So being retired the way I was, I could say, you know, take this job and shove it. And pretty much what I did, and I didn't do that. But after that, I had several good offers, and unfortunately, some I quit, and others just didn't materialize. But one of the dream jobs that was offered to me, and it was strictly through my friendship with Captain Mack out in California, Los Angeles. He was a retired Pan Am captain, and he put a little headhunting service together with a newsletter, which I subscribed to. And he would call me from time to time. We became real good friends. And he said, Neil, I got something here. You might be interested in Hawaii. And so I did. I went out to Hawaii, and I was a chief pilot and director of flight operations, actually vice president. And so I had some titles, not the chief pilot, but director of flight operations. And so at any rate, I shut that airline down myself, because it was just an accident waiting to happen. And they just they didn't know what they were doing. And I just didn't want any blemishes on my record of no violations, no speeding tickets, and, you know, not bumping into anybody on the ramp and that type of thing. So I did. I went upstairs and told the FAA I was leaving. And they said, well, you know, when you leave, we shut the airline down. And they did. They shut it down. Mm-hmm. And then after that, my dream job that didn't come true, and I was going to get involved with Virgil Tedder, but I was called by Captain Mack again, and they said, he said, Neil, he said, I talked golly, what's the name of the company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Parker Drilling Company, oil drilling company. It was the biggest in the world. Parker Drilling, oil drilling company out of Tulsa, was the biggest land operation. They didn't do any sea drilling, but they just did land oil exploration and drilling. And they needed a chief pilot for a new airplane they were going to put online. They were using 727s throughout Europe, and they were going to they thought they would come up with a 757, and they wanted to hire a chief pilot for the 757. Well, Captain Mack called me right away, and he said, Neil, he said, I think you might be interested in this job. So anyhow, make a long story short, I went out to Tulsa, interviewed with the director of flight operations for Parker Drilling Company. And I tell you what, that hangar was just like inside of a COVID. Well, it was sanitized. You could eat off mm-hmm. the floor or any airplane's mm-hmm. wing in that hangar. He had Learjets, he had helicopters and all. The old man was still alive. Parker's still alive. He's dead now. But at any rate, interviewed, and they said, okay, here's what we need. We need you to go out to Seattle and purchase 2 757s and configure them for what we want to do. And what they wanted to do mm-hmm. is they wanted to fly over it's Russia, Kazakhstan, the airport there at the Caspian Sea, just north of the Caspian Sea, where they do their space shots. And they were going to pick up drillers that were drilling out there from a mobile oil company, and they were going to bring them back to America and quit, sending them on American and whoever were the main carriers back and forth. And that way they thought they could save some money by having those 2 757s. And, of course, I quickly agreed with them. That's what they needed. It was a wonderful airplane. May have to make a fuel stop, and that's where Virgil Tedder came in. And I called Virgil, who was with Delta at the time, doing simulator instructing, I think, with the 75. And I said, Virgil, I need some numbers. And I told him what the plan was, and he put together the trip where it had to stop and gas up and all that stuff, and about what it would cost to operate the airplane. And I went back to Tulsa, and they bought it. They said, okay, we're going to do it. And they found 2 757s that had not been configured, that a couple of the airlines had one airline, I forgot which one it was, had turned them down. And it didn't take their option to pick them up. And so I was going to go out to Seattle and configure so that we would have sleeping quarters for the entire crew, because that airport there at the Caspian Sea in Kazakhstan didn't have any facilities, no Motel 6 mm-hmm. or Days Inn. And so everybody had to sleep in even the flight attendants had to sleep on board. So we were going to configure it that way. And boy, I tell you what, you're talking about being excited. I was one excited puppy. I mean, I was in Pensacola, and I was mm-hmm. in dreamland. And unfortunately, I get a call from his name was Jim. I can't think of his last name, the director of flight operations for Parker. And he said, Neil, he says, I don't think it's going to work out. And I thought, me or what? And they told me that the Russians had put a stop to Parker drilling in the oil fields there in the Kazakhstan area. And the reason for it is because they were going to pipe it out, and the Russians wanted to put a flow meter on it and have a charge of every liquid gallon going through those pipes, I guess. And Mobil Oil said, no, we're not going to do it. So we lost the right to do that, and they just decided to cancel the program. But you're talking about a dream job. That would have been a dream job. And, I could have flown over 60, because it was a Part 91 operation. It was a company-owned airplane, or airplanes. So anyhow, that's my story, and a couple of other jobs came through after that. We'll talk about it later, but anyhow, that's what happened to me. And anything else you guys want to add about your time with the airline? Did you stay with the airline you went with, and what happened to you? I think, Jim Holder, you retired from ATA, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was the first. I retired at age 60. And, of course, I flew captain, you know, most of the time I was there, because they expanded. I think when I got hired, I think I was like 327 or something like that. And, boy, you turned around, they had over 1,000 pilots. So
wow. Yeah.
We got the left seat real quick. And but I had fun flying with those other guys, though, the young guys. And, you know, the chief pilot would call me, how did such and such do and all that. And thank goodness I was able to, in every case, tell them the guy really did a good job. But they were nervous as all get out. Some of them hadn't even flown the 727. They hadn't flown captain. And now they're flying out of Midway in the winter. And they were a nervous bunch of guys. And so it wasn't just me. There was an Air Force guy in my class. He flew DC-9s and had a lot of experience. So he was based in Indy, I think. But Mike Pond was also in my class, Eastern captain, Chicago. And, of course, he was able to do the same thing I did, and we did the same thing. But it was a lot of fun flying with those young guys, and they were very appreciative of having me over there.
Yeah.
I remember this one guy, he came from TWA. And he, I can't remember, his Eastern went to, I mean, TWA came with ATA. And anyhow, he was at ATA when he flew with me, and he had been at TWA. And it was a little bit more complicated there, but I've forgotten what it was. And he told me he was a nervous wreck, because somebody told him that there was this grouchy old sumbitch, Jim Holder, and he was going to be flying. He had just finished his IOE, because I couldn't do IOE. You know, I wasn't a check airman. And he got on an airplane. And I remember at Midway, I could see him walking up the stairs outside on a jetaway, looking into the cockpit. And he could see me. And he had this terrified look on his face, because they had told him that I was just a tough old mean bastard, you know. And grouchy, because I was flying in the right seat and, you know, been a captain. But he believed all that stuff. And he came in, and, I mean, he was nervous as all get out. And I said, hey, you know, glad to meet you and all that, nice. And I said, I got the navigation all set up. We was going down to Fort Lauderdale or someplace like that. And I said, we're ready to go, you know. It's going to be a good day, good trip. And he started warming up to me, and we was taxiing out, and he started warming up even more. And we were climbing out, going through about 20,000. He said, I think somebody told me some lies about you. I said, what do you mean? He told me that you didn't mean some bitch, you don't want to be with him. And he said, I don't see that. And I said, oh, good grief, of course not, I'm not. And he told me that at the end of the trip, he wanted to fly with me some more, because he felt so good flying with me. And, you know, because he was still, you know, he hadn't flown the 727 or anything like that, you know. And it was fun. That was the kind of stuff that I did. And it was enjoyable. But I got in the left seat. And then, of course, I was able to finish my 3 years in the left seat. And actually, I was about number four in Chicago, and one in two and three. Lived in Chicago, so we got TDY all the time. So I would bid out, and you know, I spent a lot of time in Dallas all month, and Reno trips and that kind of stuff. And it was just fun. Even got to be based in Germany a couple of times. TDY.
Wow. Yeah.
So it was fun.
Well,
I got to do things I never did.
Let me play another record here and see if you can identify this young man at the time, because this was back in the 50s. And then I want to talk to Brenda. I think Brenda's with us. Brenda, are you there? Well, it's not Brenda. It must be Renee. Renee, are you with us?
I'm with you today.
Okay, I got a question to ask you after this singer does a song, and see if you remember who the singer is.
Okay.
Make the world go away. And
If you do, then forgive me and make the world go away. Make the world go away and get off my shoulders. Say sorry if I hurt you. I'll make it up day by day. Just say you love me like you used to and make the world go away. Make
singer.
I believe
Eddie
it was
Arnold.
Eddie Arnold. Let me
ask you,
is the music coming in scratchy to you, or is it just on my receiver here?
No, it's coming in. Sounded good here.
Well, if it's coming in up there in the Toronto area, I think it's coming across good then, because mine is scratchy. Renee. I forgot how to pronounce your last name. It's help me
McKinnon?
Out. McKinnon.
Renee McKinnon. Yeah.
And Renee, you were in Toronto when Eastern folded. And what did you do as far as jobs? Where did you go to work after Eastern? Or did you?
I was all over the place. I came back to Toronto and I was laid off. But when I was with Eastern in sales, I specialized in the Latin countries, so I was going around all over Canada. They did the Las Americas program. The first time they did it, they put it out to anybody who could go. So I went across Canada, and I got 54 travel agents to come down to Las Americas. So that was a huge boost for me. And because of that, they invited me down to the show. I got to go on the trip, some of the fam trips into Bolivia and La Paz and the different countries. So I was already working in the Latin market, so it was just easy to do. Just get into travel and keep on going.
Did you have to speak Spanish? Or was
no.
that a wasn't a requirement? Okay.
No.
Very good.
Yeah. But that was
well,
strange.
Yeah, it was a great airline. And, you know, the second topic that I had that I wanted to talk about is what kind of act did Eastern show you or your family while you were employed with Eastern? And I just wanted to real quickly say that I had 4 months with Eastern Airlines when tragedy struck my family, and it was on Eastern Flight 687 that departed. And I remember I looked in my logbook, June 27th, 1963, and with me as the first officer and on the Convair 440, the captain was Ernie Gossi. Jim, you might remember Ernie. He was the captain on the Convair, and we were leaving Washington, D.C., where I was based in my first year with the company, and I was living in an apartment in Annandale, Virginia, with my wife, Peggy, and our two children, Scott, who was 3.5 years old, and Shay, who was 3.5 months old. And now that old Flight 687 out of Washington to Miami went something like this. It had stops in Raleigh, Florence, Columbia, St. Simon's Island, Jacksonville, Gainesville, Ocala, Orlando, Vero Beach, and then Miami with a beautiful 30-plus hour layover in Miami where I still had my family. And then returning back to Washington much the same way as we came. And coming into Jacksonville on 687 in range for the numbers, as we called it, which was mainly the fuel, the altimeter setting, and any special request were called in to operations so they could get ready for fueling. I was asked by the guy that I was talking to on the microphone if First Officer Neil Holland was on board. And I said, yeah, immediately. I was working. I was the one that was on the microphone. And he said, well, would you come into operations as soon as you land and come on into it? It's a personal thing. And upon landing and taxiing to the gate, I left the plane and went into operations. And the station manager told me that my wife, Peggy, had a cerebral hemorrhage in Annandale that morning and was in the Fairfax Hospital in Virginia, Fairfax, Virginia. And Eastern had arranged to put me on a Washington flight on the DC-7 that was parked there at ramp. It just so happened, and its next stop from Jacksonville was Washington. So they put me right on the airplane, and they had flown in a replacement first officer from Atlanta to Jax to cover the rest of old Flight 687 down south to Miami. And upon arriving in Washington, I drove my car directly to the hospital, the Fairfax Hospital, where Peggy was in the ICU unit, and she was in a coma. And I'll never forget her, Dr. Gold, G-O-U-L-D, Gould or Gold, forgot now. But at any rate, he told me that she did not require an operation and that a blood vessel in her brain had burst, causing the hemorrhage and thus the temporary coma. And he said that she would be out of it. But it took her 2 weeks before she regained consciousness. And she was only 27 years old then, and she would have to be very careful for the next 5 years. He told me that her chances not having another stroke after that were in her favor. But she did remain in a coma for 2 weeks. But here's the thing. I had no health coverage. As you remember, we were on probation when we first came with Eastern for the first, I think it was first 15 months back in 63 when I was hired. It might have been the same for you, Jim. But at any rate, I didn't have any coverage. I didn't have any time off, no vacation, whatever. Eastern gave it all to me. They covered her hospital stay, her operation, I mean, not her operation, but, you know, the doctor, the neurosurgeon, neurodoctor, and everything, and allowed me to have as much time as I could to get someone in to help with my wife and also my two young children, in which her mother, I think a month later, flew down flew up to Washington from Burnsville, North Carolina, where they were living, and her family's from. But Eastern did that for me in a probationary position with the company. So, and they did more than that. There's some other instances that they went out of their way to help employees with that great company. And I don't know if you guys
it
got
was.
any similar stories.
Yeah, I have one.
Go ahead, George.
Well, you know, I was invited to go to Miami for Whitey John. I don't know if you guys remember him. He was a member of management, pilot. He was an old friend of the family. And I was invited
what was his
to
name
go
again?
To his Whitey John, J-A-H-N.
Oh, yeah.
You
Whitey,
know him, Jim.
Yeah.
You know him.
Yeah,
he used to come to rainbow meetings.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was invited to go to his retirement party in Miami And there was a union meeting that morning. So I got up real early and went to the union meeting. I wasn't a representative then. And then I got on the airplane. I figured, well, you know, I got the jump seat, so the guy will tell me go sit in the back. But it turned out to be a New York crew, and we wound up talking the whole time down there. So anyway, went stayed at the Marriott Hotel in Miami and went to the party. And after the party, went to a couple of, gin mills after that. And then I decided I had a couple of friends of mine from Germany who were living up in Lantana, which is just south of Palm Beach. So I said, oh, you know what? It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, I'll drive up there and see them. Well, I got like up to Fort Lauderdale, and I was really beat. And I said, I have to get off 95 and turn around and go back to the hotel. So anyway, I get off 95 and I think I fell asleep at the wheel and crashed into a bridge abutment at about 60 miles an hour. Anyway, long story short, I was declared dead twice and they revived me. So I woke up the following evening in the hospital, and who's sitting on the end of my bed? I'm on a life support system, but Tom Butchin. And I thought that was kind of funny. And I got hold of a pencil and a pad, and I said, you know, Tom, when I woke up and you were here, I thought I died and went to hell or something like that. I wrote. And he got a good laugh out of that. But my wife was there, and I found out that Eastern called her at home and told her what had happened, and gave her first class seat along with my father-in-law and my brother-in-law on the next nonstop flight to Miami, and then gave them a limo from Miami up to the hospital, which I thought was really, really nice of them to do. And it was they didn't have to do that, but they did. And
yeah,
I mean, you know, and even I thought maybe Tom was there to pull the tubes out of me, but he didn't do that. But as it turned out, I didn't need the tubes, and I knew that because of what I was told when I was dead. But anyway, that was really, I thought it was very nice of them to do it, you know.
Jim, something like that has happened to you?
No. I guess I was pretty lucky in that regard.
When John, my partner back in the 60s, John Corni, he was hired a week before I was, and we met each other there in Atlanta after they closed his base, which was New Orleans, and they closed Charlotte down, and I was based in Washington, and I was able to bid Atlanta. And he was able to bid Atlanta, and we met each other in the Campbellton Road apartment complex. And John and I became immediate friends, and a wonderful guy. We started a flight school out at Charlie Brown Airport, and we had a steerman, a 1935 Mike, that Wayne Johnson and Bob Vitel had restored. And a beautiful airplane, and they had sold it to the leading advertising agency in Atlanta, Tucker Wayne. And the guy Wayne, I think it was Wayne Tucker. But at any rate, one of the partners bought the airplane and was selling it, and we bought it. And we had it for about 2 years, I guess, before John crashed up in the fields up in Cumming, Georgia on July 4th. 1971, and was killed. And I helped pull his body out. I was monitoring the show along with my real good friend, the head of the FAA there in Atlanta, and Jim Baker, I think his name was, but he was a Southern Regional Director of the FAA. I got to know him because of our school, and we had a school there. So we became friends, and he was with me when we were monitoring the air show. But at any rate, Eastern, after John died, had me to be the Eastern representative for his family and to John. And Perry Hudson was the chief pilot at the time, and he said, Neil, he said, you be with the family as long as you want to be with them, and wherever he's going to be buried, we want you to be in uniform and attend the funeral. Of course, you know, that was going to happen anyhow, because we owned the school together, and we'd been together for 8 years at that time. And so that's what happened. He was buried up in Cleveland, and I flew with the casket. And when they took it from the fuselage and put it in the ambulance, I was there to take it to the funeral home in Cleveland. Stayed with the family for about a week, I think, as best I can recall. And Eastern said nothing, you just stay. And they honored my trip, flights missed. And it was a hell of a company. It was a hell of a company. It really was.
It was.
Maybe some of the other companies, US Air and Pan Am and Delta, all did the same. I don't know. But I just know that Eastern Airlines took care of its people.
It really did. You're right.
Now, time for another musician to play and see if you can identify this gentleman. Again, and as you know, in the last 2 weeks, famed English singer Engelbert Humperdinck lost his wife, and she was 84-year-old, and Humperdinck announced on social media that he and his wife had become infected with COVID-19 earlier this year, and it was reported February 5th that Patricia, his wife, Patricia had been hit pretty hard by the illness. Patricia, who had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease prior to that for almost a decade, reportedly stopped eating and drinking after contracting the coronavirus. And in a bid for spiritual support, Engelbert asked for prayers. And he said, I'm sure God will send the right message and the right angels and the right people over to put their hands on her. Please help me with that prayer. That's the most important thing, Hupperdinck wrote. And 2 days later, it was reported, through the pain of loss, Hupperdinck's words reflected the singer's Catholic faith. He expressed his heartfelt gratitude to well-wishers who supported Patricia with prayers in her final hours. And Engelbert went on to write a touching tribute to his wife, who had received the last rites from their nephew, who was a Catholic priest, Father Paul. And this is, I want to play this song. This is a song that he wrote after his wife passed away just recently. And it's a beautiful song, beautiful tribute to his wife of 50 plus years.
I wanted you for life, you and me in the wind. I never thought there'd come a time that our story would end. It's hard to understand, but I guess I'll have to try. It's not easy to say goodbye. For all the joy we shared, all that time we had to spend. If I had one wish, I'd want forever back again. To look into your eyes and hold you when you cry. It's not easy to say goodbye. I remember all those great times we had. So many memories, some good, some bad. Yes, and through it all, those memories will last forever. There's peace in where you are. Maybe all I need to know. And if I listen to my heart, I'll hear your laughter once more. And so I have to say, I'm just glad you came my way. It's not easy to say goodbye.
Jim, he's our age, 84 years old, and it doesn't sound quite like the Engelbert of his youth, but a great song, great tribute.
Sure was. Good.
You know, when I hear songs like that, I can put Eastern's name right in there and just think about the times and the memories that we had over the years, the many years, and that's what keeps this radio show going. And it's a lot of fun to share memories that we have done today and hope to do it next week, next Monday. And
you talk about memories. I've got memories too. And bad, some potentially bad news. Don Teal, I think he hired on right along about the same time you did. Yeah, he was. They put him in hospice day before yesterday, and he's one of my very best friends. And
great guy. Yeah.
Great guy. And but he's he went to live with his daughters out in Dallas with his wife also, and about a year and a half ago, and we had a farewell party for him here at our home, and it's tough. I'll tell you, I had a lot of contact with him, playing golf, the hunt club, fishing in the mountains, trout fishing, you know, just name everything. One of my very best friends.
I think Don was in my late partner's class, John Corni. And I say, he was a week ahead of me. And, there were some great guys. And Ernie Betts, you know Ernie real well, and you know what happened to his mm-hmm. wife. She became paralyzed from the waist down with a stroke about the same time mm-hmm. Peggy, my wife, had her stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And and Eastern treated her extremely well, and Ernie. Really good people, fine people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hope for better news, and thanks. Thank you guys for sharing your stories, and I hope you'll come back next Monday and share some more stories. These are the kind of stories that I like, and I like to throw in a few songs. But this last song is, I know all of us pilots, we feel like that we did our life at our age now the way we wanted to do it. Looking back over the years, I'm sure there's some things that Jim and Renee, we'd all like to change in our lives, but here we are at our age, and I want to dedicate this song to all the folks that have reached our age and older. So we're going to go out with this song, and I hope you can tune us in again next Monday at 1:00. But I think you'll like this selection. For all the senior guys, this is a song for you.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my way.
Amen.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew, but through it all, when there was dark, my fill, my share of losing, and now as tears subside, I find it all
so amusing to think I did all that, and may I say, not in a shy way. Oh no, oh no, not me. I did it my way. For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not to say the things he truly feels, and not the words of one who kneels. The record shows I took the blow.
George, Jim, Renee, I don't know about you, but I feel that song.
Yep. It's a good
one. Yeah, it's nice.
Okay, guys, thanks a lot. I hope to see you next week if you can make it and share some more of these great Eastern stories. That's what it's all about. See you then.
All right, Neil, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Enjoyed it.
Bye.
Enjoyed
bye-bye.
It.